Hi, and welcome to episode 13 of the Obesity Panacea podcast. On this episode, Peter and I chat with fellow science bloggers and young researchers, Jason Goldman, Christy Wilcox, and Cycurious. Now, I should warn you up front, on this episode, we don't talk specifically about obesity very much. Instead, we talk about the work that we're all doing in our research and a lot of things that we see going on in the science blogosphere. So not as much focus on obesity as usual, but we think that you're still really going to enjoy the discussion, and we'll get back to obesity and physical activity in our next podcast. So without any further ado, here's episode 13 and Science Blogger Showdown number 2. So does everybody want to introduce themselves that's on the call?
Okay, so I'll go first. I'm Peter. I blog with Travis at Obesity Panacea, and I haven't done these group ones before, so this is very exciting for me.
Okay, all right. I am Cy, and I blog at Neurotic Physiology at Scientopia. And yes, Peter, you sound so much more Canadian than Travis. Why is that?
Really?
You know, yeah
that's weird. I should have a really weird accent. I was born in Poland, and then when I was 6, we left to Greece, and I lived there for 4 years, and we came to Canada when I was 10. So I should technically sound really bizarre. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's not really Canadian accent. I just sound weird.
Maybe weird is Canadian to us.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, continuing onward, someone jumping in there, that's me, Christy. I blog over at Observations of a Nerd.
And I'm Jason. I blog at The Thoughtful Animal.
Perfect. And I think we should feel free to cut each other off, because last time I know it was kind of awkward. We didn't want to cut each other off, but please do this time. A lot of things have changed since the last time we talked. Last time we talked was June, I think, which is sort of ages ago in terms of the science blogosphere. What's everybody been doing lately? If you can summarize it.
I was on a boat.
I'm on a boat. Nice.
Did you guys sing the I'm on a boat song all the time? Because I would.
Yeah, I would have done the same.
No.
So what were you doing on the boat? Because I was like thinking about this before, and I was picturing it like Darwin, like you're like on a boat and like scribbling notebooks and drawing things. Like, what were you actually doing on the boat?
Well, a lot of diving, actually.
That's
so the
cool.
Goal, most of what the research I was doing, I was helping two different sort of groups. There's the fish team and the coral team. And so the coral team was going out and taking samples of a bunch of corals. And the fish team was going out and taking samples of a bunch of fish. So a lot of diving to find those things.
Catch the fish or just like of them, and how that's kind of creepy.
Well, we may have been spearfishing.
Uh-huh.
They were little fish, don't worry.
So do you then like cut them up?
Were they tasty?
No, you don't eat them.
Oh, well, that's terrible.
There's science here.
So are you doing like physiology stuff or what? Like, okay, so you kill them, then what?
Fish stuff, they're doing physiology, but they're doing mostly genetics. Top gen.
And so you say they are, so you're not doing that then? Like, or is this part of your PhD? Or?
My fish didn't make it onto the permit, so I was collecting other people's fish.
So onto the permit?
Well, we were up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands in the Papahanaumoku Akea National Marine Monument. Say that 5 times fast. And so you can't just collect anything you want up there. You can't even go up there, actually, without a permit. And then even after the permit to go up there is the permit to do things. Basically, everything is banned unless it's on a permit. Hence, my fish didn't make it on the permit.
So this is completely altruistic of you, or it just sounded like fun, or will this help you somehow?
Please, diving 3 or 4 times a day for a month? Altruistic.
That sounds absolutely terrible.
I don't know how.
Wait,
I would survive.
But I have an important question. Was like the fish team and the coral team, were you guys like rivals, like West Side Story? Did you guys have like contests and
dance-offs?
So we actually all kind of worked together because there were more, like there were only 2 out of the 8 or whatever sites that were actually needed coral samples taken. So the coral team kind of joined on with grabbed some spears on the other days.
That sounds
your work sounds much cooler than mine.
I know. Everything about what Christy's doing sounds so awesome. Like, you're in Hawaii, you go diving. Like, remember last time I was talking how, like, you know, I live in Ottawa where we get, like, 18 feet of snow, and I don't get to go diving as a part of my research.
But you could dive in the snow if you wanted to.
That's snow diving.
I'd say it is possible.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You get to, like, shovel driveways.
Shoveling driveway, that's true. I get to be physically active by just simply trying to get out of my apartment building, which is wonderful. And yeah. So has anybody else been doing anything even remotely as exciting as Christy?
No.
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 I mean, Peter, for your part, you did go trekking in South America for like 4 months. I mean, that was probably pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I got to dive a little bit. I was in Galapagos for a couple of weeks, so I did get to dive with turtles and stingrays and stuff like that. So that was quite a bit of fun. But that now seems like ages ago. Now I'm back to Canada. It's not nearly as fun.
I loved when you were talking about the meat sweats on your blog.
That was intense, man. I don't know what that is, but there's a certain amount of protein that once you ingest it, it's tough to not just profusely sweat at the table.
You can't just shut down and start shunting everything towards your blood towards your skin, just trying to get rid of everything.
And it was difficult because it was so we had not been eating all that well for like I mean we were in Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador, and so through those countries the food was okay, not fantastic. Bolivia, you know, particularly was a little bit weird, but. And then we got to Brazil, and there's just meat everywhere. So I'd been so deprived of protein when we got to Brazil. I was so excited to finally have a decent meal. And then we go to these rodizio things, which is just like meat, like pounds and pounds of meat just coming to your table. You don't have to move. It was fantastic at first. And then you start sweating, but you still want to keep eating because I haven't had protein in a while. It was quite the conundrum. I was having a difficult night.
Wait, were you like sweating gravy?
I was pretty shiny. I don't know if it was the consistency of gravy. I'm not really sure what was coming out of me, but it was not pretty.
Oh, my.
Well, Jason, I think you would love that, given your, you know, professed love of bacon, you know, it's and true. All things containing meat.
Every time there's an opportunity to go have a nice dinner, I make my family take me to this Brazilian restaurant where the waiters are dressed up like Brazilian cowboys and they carry around swords of meat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's the coolest thing ever.
That's exactly the type of establishment I was sweating profusely in. Yeah. So field work, eh?
Field work.
Yeah. So.
Segue, Peter.
Yeah. Well done. Thank you.
I'm smooth. Yeah.
So yeah. So we said we're going to talk about field work. So Chris, you told us a little bit about yours, I guess. Jason. We are not good at this. We're such socially awkward.
Christy's fieldwork sounds like vacation to me.
Yeah, seriously. I have
a bunch of different fieldwork stories. You do a lot of random internships, you know, going through your undergrad and stuff. I got all kinds of fieldwork.
And so, like, what, like other things on a boat or other things on boats?
Not on boats, not even entirely in salt water. All kinds of stuff.
I have to say, though, Christy, if I were, like, doing outreach to get more kids to become scientists, I would totally say, look at this girl. She goes diving for months. She's a scientist.
Yeah, that's a lot sexier than the type of stuff that we would normally do. Like, hey, you want to go to the hospital and look at people? Not really fun.
Hey, do you want to put on this incredibly not form-fitting white lab coat? Yes, you do.
Hey, yeah. I got to share a lab coat time.
I get to play with puppies.
Really?
Yeah. Wait, do you have to hurt them afterwards?
No.
Did you spear them like Christy?
And then eat them?
Because that's how they do science in Hawaii. They just spear endangered species. I'm kidding.
No one needs ethics.
We do not spear the puppies. We go out into the field and work with dog owners and breeders.
Doing, like, what are you trying to do?
Oh, just simple behavioral stuff, you know. Kind of stuff I write
like
about.
Like stripes, like horizontal stripes versus vertical stripes, like they did to the cats, and then all of a sudden.
No. We do not raise them in our lab.
No. I gotta say, I remember in undergrad, and this isn't fieldwork at all, but I remember in my neuroscience course, I'm talking about decerebrated cats that they'd like cut their spinal cord, but and then they put them on a treadmill and they'd still walk. And I remember thinking that was the – and it's like a reflex. And I remember thinking, like, that is the coolest thing ever. And then my prof was saying how in babies, if you, like, pull them along the carpet, they have this, like, innate reflex. And I remember trying with my cousin that he didn't do it. And I was so depressed because I told, like, my whole family, like, this is this reflex that babies have, and it's going to be so cool. And he just, like – I just, like, drug them along the carpet. Yeah, and so I've tried it with other babies, and I can never get it to work. And so I'm not sure if you just wrong.
Maybe on the top of, like, water, like, on top of, like, a swimming pool or something.
Yeah.
There's a swimming reflex.
And like, holding them horizontal?
Like, I would never let go of the child because they would certainly...
Thank you for that, Jason, for that public service announcement.
No, I do. Now get some information we're sharing. They put, like, they have the swimming with baby classes, and the babies actually swim really well. Like, newborns do really well.
I'm picturing the cover of Nevermind by Nirvana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was a good album.
And so, well, Jason, so is that the only type of field work you do? Like,
I've also gone out to schools, you know, as part of my child development studying reading, which is, I actually don't like it at all. It's a pain in the ass. But it's a lot easier to get parents to agree, to consent, for us to work with their kids if it's part of the school day than if they have to make a special trip out to campus. So that's, you know, and then we can power through, you know, 10 subjects in a school day, that way, instead of scheduling parents and kids to come out to campus on a weekend or on a school holiday or whatever. So we go out to schools a lot, actually.
I did some last year.
What reading tests do you do with kids?
Oh, we've got a whole battery of, you know, just kind of standard neuropsychological stuff, IQ tests, tests of sight word reading, you know, reading words from memory, timed and not timed, and tests of phonological awareness, you know, the ability to sort of manipulate the sounds of language. We give them verbal IQ, spatial IQ, whole bunch of stuff, and probably... In total, we probably do about 2.5 to 3 hours of testing. Not all at once. We usually do it in two sessions.
Like 2 to 3 hours per subject? Like per kid?
Yeah. I mean, and part of that is just because, you know, kids are kids and they want to take a break every half an hour after every test or whatever. But like with the adults, we, you know, the adult version of our test battery could probably be done in a little over an hour. But the kids, we do it in 2 hour, hour and 15 minute blocks.
So do you come armed with candy or some kind of word for the child?
Well, when we go out to the schools, we actually, like...
Pull up in a van and offer candy at the side of the street.
Well, so the
come here, kids, lollipops.
The teachers don't want us to give the kids candy. And we can't pay them because they're in school. If they, you know, if they came out to the lab on a weekend or something, we could pay them. Usually, what we do is we sometimes give them just little trinkets and toys and stuff, you know, erasers, things that kids are into.
Kids are into erasers?
Well,
hey,
like,
I'm still into erasers. All right?
Jason was an exciting child, weren't you, Jason?
If you just, like, have a, you know, a bag full of, like, stuff and you tell them to close their eyes and reach their hand in, like, they'll be excited with whatever they pulled out. Because it's like a game.
Sounds like a dangerous game, Jason. Dangerous, dangerous game. Close your eyes, kids. Pull something out of a bag. See what happens.
Close your eyes. Put your hand in the bag.
Was this in your ethics? Did you write this up? Or?
Yes.
I would love to read the description of that.
But when they come to campus, we obviously pay them and their parents.
Right. So you're allowed to pay kids, because we up here we have a real trouble paying kids in Canada, it seems.
Well, part of it is when they come out to campus, we do it all in one day instead of in 2 days. And usually, if we invite them to campus, it's because we also want them to do an MRI for us.
Oh, okay.
So all of that together, like, you know, a 4 hour afternoon or morning with a kid. We'll give them, like, $20, and we'll give the parent $20, and we'll pay for their parking or whatever.
Right. Oh, okay.
Hey, I just have to say, my MRIs are worth way more than $20 at my institution.
Well, we...
I don't know about you guys.
We obviously pay a lot more for the scanner time.
Yeah.
See, I got, like, you know, $100 an hour for MRI studies, depending on the studies, obviously. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's actually pretty good.
Study, so that's probably why.
Oh, yeah.
See, up here, we have trouble getting anything through ethics where we pay for anything more than, like, reimbursing, you know, very minimal amounts.
I need to, like, become a kid or do something to get myself involved in these studies as subjects.
Or agree to be put in large amounts of pain while in an MRI scanner.
Yeah, that's worth $100.
Like, from something you were doing in the MRI or just from being, like, stuck in that fixed position so long? Because I remember my shoulders, like, going completely numb trying to hold a Superman position for, like, 2 hours once.
Oh, no, they actually, it was a hot electrode that they put on your leg.
Oh, Jesus.
And, basically they had you go in beforehand and they'd measure, like, your tolerance for pain. And so they'd put it right at the point where you said, I can't take it anymore.
Wow.
And
so they'd, like, yeah.
Yeah, that?
It was really hard because you have to lie very, very still. And, of course, when you have a hot thing on your leg, your first instinct is to pull away. So your leg is twitching like mad, and you're trying desperately to hold it in place.
This sounds terrible.
Yeah, you should drop what you're doing in your postdoc and move to Hawaii and work with Christy right now.
I don't think so. Christy, does your boss need a postdoc?
I don't know if he needs a postdoc. We did just get one. He's Canadian, by the way.
Hey, success.
There you go. Yeah.
Does he have a dog?
Not that I know of.
If he gets a dog, then I can come too.
I'm sure there's plenty of people with dogs around here. There's enough
I'm
of
just
them.
Thinking we could all be a great, awesome research team, all trained in spearfishing and coral.
We could have our own, could have our own separate boat, just us. It'd be awesome.
I do have my Pleasurecraft operator's card, so I'm good to go there.
We could all there have matching nautical themed Pashmina Afghans, you guys. Wow.
That sounds like field research.
Yeah, well, and actually, though. To bring it back to field research, though, because when we go to schools, you're right, it is way more time effective. Like, we do assessments of motor skills and fitness and these sorts of things. And so we'll go and do, you know, 30 or 40 kids in an afternoon. But like you said, you know, kids get bored. And if their station isn't moving, they kind of, you know, start running around and stuff. And so we take all this juggling equipment. And whenever there was downtime, I would just juggle. And since we were doing, you know, the kids were like grades 4, 5, 6, that's like prime juggling age. So I juggled and teach them to juggle. And it's fantastic. It's like, it's the best way I've ever seen to like get kids to just like calm down and do something constructive. It's awesome.
Wait, so better than erasers?
So, I've never directly compared juggling with erasers, but I'm willing to speculate that they might be more effective.
You should try it next time. Erasers school.
Yeah, I was going to say, clearly we need to have a competition here.
Yeah, I'll give them the option. You can reach into this bag of erasers.
With your eyes closed.
Or you can watch me juggle and then learn how to do it yourselves. So I will try that.
Not everybody knows how to juggle.
No, but anyone can learn. Anyone can learn. It's like riding a bike.
So when you give physical fitness tests to the kids, like, is it like the presidential fitness test like they do in America? Or like what kind of...
Well, it's based on the fitness gram, which is from the States. It's from the Cooper Clinic in Texas, which I don't know what the presidential one is, but it's we do like a beep test. So have you guys done the beep test?
I don't know. What is a beep test like?
Soccer teams do it a lot in basketball teams. You line up at one end of the gym, and you have a CD that plays a beep, and then you try to get to the other end of the gym before the beep. And so it starts out really slow. And then gradually the beeps get closer and closer together, and you go until you can't get to the other end before the next beep. And so then you can use that to estimate someone's aerobic fitness. So it's good for doing like large groups of kids at a time. And so it starts out like almost at a walking pace, and then by the end you're sprinting back and forth.
Cool.
And so we do that, and then we do things like it's also based on the Canadian Physical Activity and Fitness Lifestyle Approach, which is things like sit-ups, push-ups, and, you know, we do waist circumference, just sort of really basic stuff. We do some motor skills, like have them kick a ball and have them, like, swing a bat and sort of mark on a score of, like, 1 to 5 if they're doing the skill at, a high-functioning level or that sort of thing. So sort of a range of things. We're actually trying to develop this overall assessment of physical literacy, and so sort of the whole point is trying to develop the best test for testing these kids.
Is that what your research is about?
No, it was one of the projects that's going on within my group, but it's not my PhD. Like, I'm presenting data on it at a conference coming up this year, but it was just one. Before I started my PhD with this lab, I was an RA with this lab, so I was doing this in the summer and then just kind of helped out throughout the school year when they needed an extra hand or two.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I was
Things sound so safe.
Well, I was actually wondering, Travis, about the physical fitness assessments. You have them do, like, hand-eye coordination stuff. Is that something related? It seems like that's not really a measure of how healthy you are.
Well, this is...
Just aren't coordinated.
Well, no, this is an excellent point, and it comes to the whole... it's this term of physical literacy, and so it's sort of like, you know, literacy with reading isn't just grammar, it's not just... you know, recognizing words and vocabulary is sort of an encompassing term that has a number of different facets. And so physical literacy sort of is motor skills, it's your fitness, it's your knowledge of sports, because these are all things that impact your ability to be active. Like, obviously, if you can't throw or catch a ball, you're not going to play baseball. And so if you have poor motor skills as a kid, you're less likely to be active as an adult. So it's trying to sort of develop this test that can overall, you know, get a good feel for someone's ability to live an active lifestyle later on. Does that make sense?
Would you then maybe try and develop like things that can help people with motor skills or?
Oh yeah.
Give them ballet lessons.
Yeah, and so that's not really like the purpose of this study, but there is absolutely stuff going on like that. Yeah, and there's a lot of cool research into these kids that have developmental coordination disorder, and it's like clinical klutziness. Like their kids, it's.
I'm just curious.
They call it the TGMD too. I don't know what it is, but they give them a bunch of motor skill tests. But the interesting thing about these kids is that you can teach them a skill and they won't improve. Like they have poor motor skills, but they can't actually learn the skill. Whereas like a normal kid, if you have them shooting a basketball, they'll gradually improve. But so it's fascinating to see videos of these kids like shooting a puck and stuff, and after hundreds of shots, they're still not learning, but those kids are more likely to be obese as adults and inactive and stuff. So it's really interesting, kind of then trying to figure out, okay, well, how do you help them to become more active and stuff, or give them the skills they need? It's kind of
cool.
Well,
do you know, is it if it's kind of a learning disability, are there neurological implications for why they're not capable of?
Well, this is
hand-eye coordination sort of thing.
And this is, because I'm not an expert on this, but my friend and colleague Megan, this was an area that she really studies, and I'm pretty sure that part of the definition is that you don't have any actual cognitive or physical deficits, which sort of seems like a paradox. Like, how can you have this problem if there's no physiological reason for having this problem? So it's still, and I'm not sure, I might be getting something wrong there, but I don't think I am. It's sort of one of these things that they're still trying to figure out exactly what it is, and it seems kind of confusing to me at this point.
Well, it's also possible there's a physiological deficit they just haven't discovered yet.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like that, and that seems like the most reasonable thing. But it's a very interesting group of kids to study.
And there's probably a huge amount of heterogeneity, right? So there's probably multiple things going on in any group of kids.
Yeah, well, that's like our friend Yoni, who's another obesity blogger, was talking about a paper on this, and he was saying, well, maybe these kids aren't actually, you know, inactive because they have bad motor skills. Maybe they have bad motor skills because they don't like being active. And so they, you know, just don't learn on their own kind of thing. So, yeah, I think there probably is a whole lot of stuff going on. So field research.
That was field research.
It is. Well, I kind of wanted to ask, like, since there have been so many changes in the past month, I mean, Peter and I left Science Blogs. Like, curious, you left Science Blogs and are now, you know, the bulwark of a new network. Jason's straddling two networks. Christy, you're still on Science Blogs. Like, where's everybody see things going in the next little while? Like, it's a really interesting time, and everyone seems to be, you know, giving their predictions on where things are moving. What do you guys think?
Future? You want me to think about the future? I'm trying to stay in the moment here.
I'll say that I think the last few weeks have been very interesting. I don't think we're done yet. I think the next 6 to 8 weeks will continue to be very interesting.
Well, and Ed Young says that there's at least two networks still coming, right? I think I read that on his blog the other day.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what I'm talking about.
I think yeah.
Over the next, you know, between 1 month and 2 months, as the dust continues to settle and, new areas are colonized. It'll be interesting to see how things sort of level out.
Do you think
I'm actually very interested in the idea that it just seems like everyone is gravitating toward these organizations of bloggers in ways that they weren't before. And I'm wondering if that's just because there are all of a sudden organizations to gravitate to. I mean, did everyone just always want to be part of a blogging organization and never had the opportunity? Or is this something that people are suddenly thinking of for the first time as being a really useful model? You know, like maybe people are now seeing it can be something that's full of smaller groups rather than just big ones like Discover and Science Blogs.
I mean, I explicitly wanted to be on Science Blogs when we started blogging. Like, I was already showing Peter Science Blogs and Seed Magazine. So, like, for us, it was always, like, trying to get on the network. I remember sending emails to that, like, the email address that no one checks about, like, to submit your blog for Science Blogs. Like once a month we would submit our blog and stuff. So, like, I mean, Carl Zimmer had a nice post in this the other day, sort of asking, you know, why does everyone want to be on blogs, and I think, or on a network, and I think for us there have been a lot of real benefits. I mean, meeting people like you guys, but also getting more exposure. Like, it seems like there were no benefits of being solo for us compared to being part of a network. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think
go ahead, Jason.
I think the, you know, PepsiGate probably sharpened everyone's awareness of the usefulness of the network effect. But also, I think some of these other networks, you know, that have sort of become more visible in recent weeks and months, they were there before, but it, you know, Science Blogs dominated, and Science Blogs was the place to be. You know, and then at some point, Discover became the place to be, you know, if you could hack it. So as things, I think, are becoming more spread out, these other networks rise in importance because Science Blogs is less is no longer the destination that it once was.
But isn't it still, like, I mean, I have no idea what the traffic numbers are on Science Blogs, but it seems like people like you guys that are still there are still doing very well. Like, it doesn't seem like Science Blogs is in no way dying. It seems like these other places are sort of also doing well and not at the expense of Science Blogs. Or am I wrong on there? Or?
I don't think it's dying. I don't think it's as important as it once was. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to find what was being written by bloggers about science, you went to scienceblogs.com, right? It
was
the last 24 hours. But now there's Science Blogs, there's Scientopia, there's PLOS, there's, I know, there's Discover, there's The Guardian, there's Lab Spaces, there's Science 2.0, and half a dozen other ones that I'm sure I'm forgetting.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot.
It's just, and my point is, I think some of those institutions, some of those networks existed before, but they just didn't matter as much.
Now, Christy, you were going to say something before.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I was going to say a lot of what you just said. I think it's sort of like Science Blogs. I haven't actually specifically looked at traffic levels or anything, but I think it's sort of like, it's still doing well, but it's not the place to go anymore. There's a lot of places to go.
Do you think everything's going to survive? Like, do you think this is one of those things where, like, there are a whole bunch of new, you know, to put in, like, evolutionary things, like a whole bunch of strains now, and the strong are going to survive, and then some will die? Like, that in 6 months, you know, half of us could be looking for new networks because they will have flamed out already? Or do you think that they're all going to sort of thrive in their own ways? Because it's hard to follow all these blocks.
But Scientopia has an excellent ability to citric acid and convert that to glucose, and we also have a very strong protonaceous coat. So I have very good faith in our ability to survive.
I think it depends on what the science or what the blogging network's goals are. Like, Scientopia, I think, has this particular, I don't know what to call it, je ne sais quoi.
Hey, nice. It's like you're
not the motivation behind it, the people that are at it. I think it's. I don't want to say they don't care if other people read them, but it's sort of like you guys have what you have, and it's not about money, it's not about publicity, it's not about whatever. So I don't think you'll fail because you already have what you have and there's nothing to fail.
Well, I think that's true for some extent. To some extent. I certainly do want people to read me, and you all should read me if you don't already. But, I mean, I certainly want people to read me, and I really want to do my best to reach out to various audiences with my work. But I think what I was really going for, what we were all going for with Scientopia, was kind of just a community. You know, we are there to work with each other and to work with other bloggers and have detailed conversations. We're not really necessarily just in it for ourselves, I don't think. We're in it for the sake of the community we can form in between ourselves and in between the people we are talking to, our audience, as well as other blog networks. We're very into creating discussion.
I think a lot of, the discussion I've seen online, it seems like bloggers really like what you guys are going for because it's because of that community. Like, I'm not sure if the public sort of has caught on to that as much so far or not, but it feels like bloggers really appreciate that idea because they get it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or they want to be a part of that. I have a hard time following all the blogs because I used to just go to science blogs, like Jason said, and just click the drop-down menu and click on one and click it again and click on something else. Now I've got to, there's so many websites to go to. I find it hard.
Go to science blogging. Is it scienceblogging.org or whatever?
That Bora has.
Yeah.
I haven't succeeded. Yeah.
It's a really incredible. It's basically like an RSS feed.
Of everything.
24 hours of every single science blog network on the planet.
Is Plogs on there yet? Because I remember checking it before Plogs had started, but I haven't checked it since.
I would imagine it's there.
I think it's up there.
Cool. Awesome.
But how do you guys, do you, like, Travis, Peter, you guys, congratulations on your move to Plogs. do you guys feel like, how do you feel that your community is going to be, how is it going to be like other communities? How is it going to be different?
Peter, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I guess the sort of the goal, as you guys probably can tell, because I think Brian Mossop has written quite a bit about this, is sort of combine science writers with scientists writing about science. So that makes us pretty nice, and sort of some of the discussion we're having sort of behind the scenes is really quite nice. So the group definitely seems very cohesive, and everyone's sort of trying to help everyone out. So. Whereas when we joined science blogs, we came on obviously fairly late. We stayed very shortly, so I really didn't feel like there's much of a community there, and I think it may have just been due to the size. So when you have what I guess it was up to 80 or whatever when we were there, and I think it was just sort of hard to to really get to know anyone on the network itself. Whereas here the group is smaller. So Travis, correct me if I'm wrong. We have 8 or 10 blogs, or
I think 10.
Yeah,
depending on how you count it, I think it's around 10.
Yeah, so it's a smaller group, but and sort of I see already sort of the writers sort of picking up a lot of the tricks and trades of blogging, and we're learning a lot of things sort of about, if we're interested in pitching a book, for example, then it seems to be right now fairly sort of beneficial for both sides. So so far it's been very good. How this is going to survive, how it'll pan out, it's interesting because we already see sort of the differences in posting styles with sort of they're more traditional science writers where they write really detailed long pieces and their frequency of posting is a little lower, whereas we'd sort of do, what we can do in a typical day and post rather frequently. So it's already sort of seeing stylistic differences between sort of science writers and scientists who blog. So those things are kind of interesting that are coming out right now.
It's been kind of impressive too. Like, I was really impressed reading like Steve Silberman, and like Deborah Bloom had a post yesterday on carbon monoxide, which was not a super long post, but it was just the way she made it into a really nice narrative was – I was really impressed. I sent Peter an email. I was like, man, I wish I could do that, take two or three studies and make this really nice narrative. And, yeah, so it's nice that. So – and, they seem to be trying to go for a community and a small one. So I don't know. So far so good. But it's going to be really interesting to see sort of which ones really take off because, with The Guardian, that one I think – could be really good just because it's The Guardian. They've got girl scientists, they've got some good bloggers there, like Mo Cost I think contributed this week already. Like it's pretty exciting, I think, in like a nerdy way.
Well, I kind of like to I'd like to hope that it's not going to be necessarily a fight for survival. I think it'd be a nice change in the ecosystem if we have a whole bunch of networks with a whole bunch of different personalities,
I think
Science Blogs has so much to offer. Heck, it's got Christy. It's also got Jason, so it's got, Science Blogs has a lot to offer. Plogs has a great deal out there. The Guardian looks amazing. There's all these different things that are forming, and I'd like to hope that they can all kind of each develop their own area of expertise. I would call it a niche, except I can never figure out whether it's pronounced niche or niche.
I prefer niche. I think niche is the Canadian way. Niche is like the...
like pretentious, oh, we must find our niche.
No, in Canada we know how to say French things, and niche is the preferred way on this podcast.
I'm not going to conform to your methods of pronunciation.
We also add you to everything, so just be aware.
Before this gets too far derailed, I just want to point out something that that Ed Yong said a few weeks ago, either on Twitter or on the blog or something, which is that it's really good. I think, and I agree, I think it's a good thing that more and more people have an opportunity to get their stuff read and to be noticed. But what it's going to mean is that we're all going to have to up our game if we want to keep those eyes on our blogs.
Which is good. I mean, that increases everybody's efficiency, right? It's like basic economic theory. That's good.
Right. So I think you're quoting Ed, you should have to say it in a London accent.
I can't do a British accent. But it would totally, like, I was listening to his, like, session at Solo the other day, and I was like, oh my god, Ed Yong has a British accent.
Yeah, that was definitely, met him the first night at Science Online last year, and it's like, you know, he would in theory, but you meet him and you're just like, wait, what?
Yeah, I had no idea either, actually, because I had no idea where he was from, so it caught me off guard at Scio 10.
It's very funny, though, because pretty soon you start reading people's blog posts in their voice.
Yeah.
You know? Like, now Jason, and Jason sounds like Jason.
See, it throws me off when I read Bora's blog, because Bora's accent, in my head, I'm like, because I hear it, and I'm like, that is so weird that I can hear his accent in my head.
I definitely read your blog with a Canadian accent in mind.
Yeah, it definitely, it sounds better that way, I find. Yeah,
yeah, it makes more sense. It's the way it was intended to be read.
You just go, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I hope you guys also, especially Travis and Peter, are looking at some of the posts that Drug Monkey's been putting out lately on the addiction involved in exercise and new studies that are coming out on, like, how exercise can either help treat addiction or is an addiction in and of itself, and what does that mean? Really interesting series of posts.
Are those really recent? Because I think last time I checked his blog was, like, late last week, I think.
Oh, no, Monday. Yeah.
Monday. Oh, okay. Is it on...
Monday and Wednesday.
Is it on the Scientopia one, or the Science Blogs one, or his other one? I get confused now. I never know where he's writing.
There's
like 12 Drug Monkey blogs.
I know, but there's no official, like, I'm done post. Then I see one from, like, a week ago. I'm like, well, I guess he's still blogging here?
He's trying to keep the bunny roll Science Blogs.
So.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's
I'm probably going to pick up on that and do some of that stuff also coming up, because I think it's a really, really interesting question.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you.
As you probably know, being a major distance runner, exercise is highly addictive.
Yes, yes, it's absolutely.
Anecdotally speaking.
Well, that's...
See, I've never had that problem.
Me either.
I definitely find that to be the case. I go a little nutty if I miss my workouts, and my girlfriend always knows when I'm getting a little cranky. It's either I'm hungry or I need to work out.
Well, Peter, we talked about this, I remember, a year or two ago. Didn't you find some paper, I'm not sure if you're going to remember, on, like, I think it was dopamine responders, non-responders, and it was like some people just cannot physically get a runner's high because they don't have something in their brain. And some people like us just have tons.
Never got runner's high, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I hate running.
I hate it with passion.
Running is awesome.
We were at a conference, I think.
You just haven't done it
enough. No, it's not.
I've done it too much.
Anytime.
What is that post with the dopamine increases in the concept of the runner's high? I'd really, if you can send me that paper, if you know what it is.
It was a while ago. It might not even be dopamine. Do you know, Peter?
It might not even be running. No, it wasn't running, actually. I think it was. We were at a conference, or maybe I may have been there by myself, I don't remember. But I remember sitting in the back sort of half bored, and then something came up that was interesting. And I think they were looking at sort of people that they had basically just had a physical activity intervention. So I think they had just started with, like, let's say 50 people who were obese, and they were trying to sort of figure out why some people stuck with their program and other people really had a hard time. And I don't remember the physiological reason behind it, but I remember being really fascinated because we never really could explain what.
Did Peter just drop out?
I think Peter just
he did.
Okay,
here, I'm calling him back. Well, in the meantime, we'll wait for that. I have one other question for you, Jason. How do you have time to blog on Science Blogs, Scientopia, and researchblogging.org all at the same time?
Well, research
and do a PhD.
Research blogging is just the editor's selections once a week. It takes me about 45 minutes, maybe. It's really not that intense. And as far as the other stuff, the blog that I share with Melody over at Scientopia, I don't feel the need to feed that blog the way I feel the need to feed my science blogs blog, partially because I have a co-blogger, and partially because when we set it up, I was like, you know, I'll contribute when I have something that I want to write about child development, and when I don't have something I want to write about child development, I just won't post. And she's sort of, you know, she's really a great writer, and to be honest, part of the reason I wanted to get that blog going was so that she would blog.
Yeah, she's really doing some incredible stuff.
Good. Well, on that note, should we wrap up and everyone can say where they can be found online? That sound good? Sure. Or was there anything else anybody else wanted to talk about?
Not that I can
say. Say about again?
About. Is that...
Say it a few more times. Just
wait, but how do you guys say it? You guys say it. And how do I say it differently? About.
Yeah, you totally do.
That's what about, I'm listening, and it all sounds exactly the same to me. That is really weird. I can't tell the difference.
All right, well, let's wrap it up then. So, so of course, we can be found at our new site and blogs at blogs.plos.org/obesitypanacea. Really, really easy. You'll never forget
Google
that one.
Really well, too.
Yeah, just...
Easy to type.
All right, Psycurious, where can people find you?
People can find Psycurious at scientopia.org/blogs/Psycurious. Or if you Google neurotic physiology, that'll get you there, too. Jason?
You can get me at scienceblogs.com/thoughtfulanimal. Or you can find my shared development blog with Melody at scientopia.org/blogs/childsplay.
Christy?
Okay. I was gonna say, I guess I'll go. You can find me at Observations of a Nerd at scienceblogs.com/observations.
Awesome. All right, well, thanks a lot, everybody, for doing this again. It was a lot of fun, and hopefully we can do it again without waiting like 5 months next time. This was fun. All right, well, have a good night, and, well, Christy, have a good afternoon, and everybody else have a good night.
All right.
Okay, all right.
Talk to you guys.
All right, bye.